The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 727. It's the 7th of March, 2017. Lots of sevens in there. On the podcast today, I have Paul Vonk, Managing Director of Angus Energy. That's ANGS, and Paul is answering private investor questions off the back of their recent Brockham Field update. Also on the podcast, I have Joe Wiley, CEO of Amrit Pharma, AMYT, talks about their Phase 3 trial discussions with the FDA and EMA for their AP101 product. I also have Simon Clifton, co-founder and chief technology officer of Satellite Solutions Worldwide, SAT's ticker, covers their 3 acquisitions they recently made, which brings their total of 14 acquisitions in 14 months. Also on the podcast, I have, as always, the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. Now, there's no prizes for guessing which company is number 1 after yesterday's stratospheric, explosive rise. But there's a couple of new ones in there as well. Also on the podcast, I have top 3 most liked RNSs on Vox Markets this morning.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Vonk, Managing Director of Angus Energy. That's ANGS. Paul, thanks for chatting to me again.
Justin, thanks for having me back on the show again.
Yeah, well, listen, you've done a lot since we last spoke. I mean, you were just floating there, but since you've done a lot, the work program has been fierce, and the results seem to be pretty good. But before we get into some questions from private investors, can you give a summary as to what Angus Energy is all about for people not aware, please, Paul?
Oh, perfect, Justin. I'll be happy to. Well, I'll keep it very brief because we've got a lot of interesting things to talk about. But Angus Energy, we only floated on the stock market in November last year. We then raised money to drill 2 wells. The first one we just drilled in January 2016, the sidetrack at Brockham. And that's come up with some great results. The next one is coming up shortly, where we're going to drill a new production well at our Litsi oil field. And that's what we are. We are at the moment still a relatively small oil and gas producer in southern UK, focused on the Weald Basin. And that's where, you know, the area is really going through a transformation.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get to the questions. First one. In the January RNS, there was a pleasant surprise noted that during the drilling of the hydrocarbons were picked up in the Carillion formation. Can you shed any further light on this? Is there, for example, signs of oil or gas in commercial quantities?
Well, during the drilling of the Brockham BRX4SAT sidetrack, we encountered hydrocarbons in all 3 layers that we were interested in. The Portland, the Kimmeridge, and the Carillion. The Carillion also had some gas. The Portland we've always been producing from at the Brockham site, but the Kimmeridge and the Carillion were new. So after we drilled it, that was the initial results came out. Since then, in the past few weeks, we've done a lot of detailed analysis with third parties looking at the well interpretation and log interpretation, but also doing a detailed geochemical analysis of all the cuttings that we received throughout the well. And the one thing that it came back with is that the Kimmeridge, and the Kimmeridge results are, you know, we couldn't have asked for better results because what we were looking for at the Kimmeridge is like, is this like Horsehill, which successfully float from the Kimmeridge layers? And if so, you know, what are the characteristics and is it the same? Well, it came back as basically carbon copy with even thicker layers of interest and higher organic oil content. So we have one well bore that has now prime access through, you know, the Portland, Kimmeridge and Carillion. But you can only produce from one layer at a time. So the Carillion really looking interesting, but Kimmeridge is looking even far better. The Portland, we can always put in production at a later stage, but we actually now need to use the wellbore to actually produce from the Kimmeridge. And that kind of, you know, then you cannot produce from the Portland or from the granny layers until you've actually finished producing from the Kimmeridge.
I understand. Okay, next question. Hi, Paul. First of all, congratulations on the great find at Brockham. Could you please let us know what is the expected break-even price for the oil produced from this well? Many thanks.
It is still very early stage to say anything about production rates or indeed the cost to those rates. I can be very, you know, we can be very brief on what we expected from the Portland. The Portland, under our analysis and what Exodus, you know, the independent reserve auditor verified, they said you can produce for about $22 a barrel. Mm-hmm. With the skimmerage, we expect much higher flow rates, and because we've already drilled the well, we therefore expect that the actual OPEX, because you have higher flow rates, should also be lower.
Okay, cool.
But it's too early to give any numbers.
Yeah, I understand. All right, our next question. What are your next steps at Brockham?
Our next steps at Brockham is that we at Brockham have a production license. We're operating under the production license, as we have been for years, producing from the Portland. And now we found this really good layer of the Kimmeridge. What we have to do is we have to go back to the Oil and Gas Authority and share the information with them, have a discussion with them about everything that we found and why we think it's prudent to put the Kimmeridge layer into production. That will require a addendum to the field development plan, which the OGA needs to sign off on. And they're basically the only ones that need to do so, because from a service perspective, like therefore from a planning perspective, nothing really changes. Until now, we have not changed the footprint of the site, and we will only do so after we, you know, we've put the first well properly into production from the Kimmeridge.
Okay, so it's just going back to the ONG and asking for that addendum to be added. So there's no local planning issues required here, is there?
Correct. No, what we have is we have this site that has been basically we are operating from under a planning permit, has been granted in the 90s, that is valid up till 2036, I believe. And we haven't changed the well bores. We just want to produce oil from them, and that is all fine. What we are doing is like a technicality. We're moving from one layer to another layer, and that is something that the OGA needs to sign off on. Obviously, when we are, you know, successfully producing from the BRX4Z, we will be very much incentivized to produce more from that Kimmeridge layer, because it's a gigantic layer, and obviously we'd like to produce as much from it as we can. So the information we will get after we put the BRX4Z into production will then feed into, you know, a long term field development plan that we want to do at Brockham, because we want to drill multi-well pads from Brockham. We want to use that real estate as we have, where we basically cannot increase the footprint, but we can drill many, many more wells on it. And for that, we will ultimately, of course, need to have, you know, authority of permission from the planning authorities to do so. But until now, we haven't made any changes to the surface.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a very, very interesting point. And I think at the start, when you first floated, a lot of people didn't understand that. You know, what you have is a production license, and no one else in that area, you know, has that. And so it's very valuable. Just a quick thing on the flow testing. So a couple of people did ask, why hasn't flow testing been done? So is that why? Could that explain why?
Well, correct. Is that all the licenses around us and all our, you know, competitors slash partners, they have a production and exploration, a PEDL license, production, exploration and development license. Mm-hmm. And in order to confirm a production, exploration and development license into a production license, you obviously need to go through a testing phase, the well test phase, which our friends at Horse Hill Developments are doing at the moment. But if you already have a production license, then you don't need to go through that stage. And what we also want to do is we want to put it in production for a long time, because that will only give us the information to put a long-term field development plan into play.
I understand. Okay. Next question is, when will technical data for field be released, like oil in place figures, etc.?
Well, it's very early to come up with those numbers, because it is also slightly different from the conventional reservoirs as people are familiar with, where you can, you know, based on your seismic results and the closure, you can say we've got X amount of oil in place and we expect these recovery rates. This is slightly different, because we're going to produce oil from the source rocks. So the oil in place is an enormous figure. It's absolutely enormous. Is an enormous figure. What is going to be interesting is indeed what are the production rates that the fracture systems are going to give us, and what are the decline curves, and therefore what are the eventual, you know, recovery rates that you could achieve from these very large numbers to begin with, and. From a technical point of view, it's too early to say, but we will come with that in due course. But it's very big, the numbers.
Okay, I quite like the next question, and I suspect I know what the person who submitted the question would like the answer to be. Here it is. Is Angus going to be a small or huge player in the UK onshore oil?
How can I answer that? Well, very simply, we're going to be a huge player. That's the intention. For the very simple reason is that we're starting off with the best real estate in the Wheel Basin. The Wheel Basin is going through basically technical transformation. What do we have here? How can we produce from it? How well will it produce? And then, you know, how much money can we actually make doing it? Now, we have to realize it's going to be a different play from in the States. So, you know, what a lot of people that had concerns about the drilling are saying is like, it's going to turn into Texas. No, it's never going to turn into Texas, because it is not the acreage position story. It's not how much acreage you have as an oil and gas company. It's about what can you access. So do you have the drilling pads, and can those drilling pads access the oil? So that is going to drive the valuation of the company. And at this moment, and we're looking to expand, you know, our position in the future, but we are fully funded. We're fully funded to bring Brockham into production. We're fully funded to bring Lissy into production. And we're fully funded to, you know, participate in the Homewood well, which is next door, the second drilling pad that we are now have in the Wheel Basin. Potentially, Lissy could also have Kimmeridge access. So what we have is we have the prime real estate to access that from. And we're going to, with that production license in place, we can basically leapfrog all our competitors around it and basically be the consolidator. That is the plan.
Yeah, cool. All right, next question. When do you intend to re-enter the other five wells?
Well, we have three wells at the site at the moment. One is a producer from the Portland, one is a water injector, and now we want to put this one into place as a Kimmeridge producer. We can fast-track the Portland producer into a Kimmeridge producer as well. We'd like to keep the water injector for a variety of technical reasons. With those two wells in place, I think then it's going to be, you know, how you're going to do it. It's going to be much more important. How do we want to do the long-term field development plays? How do you place, you know, 10 or 12, you know, new production wells into this site without impacting the other one? So that's a question that that will, you know, take some time to answer. But with the wells that we have, we want to put them into production as fast as we can.
Okay, next question is, I see you only found three smaller layers in the Kimmeridge compared to Fort Horse Hill. Is Brockham a different structure?
No, it is. That is not correct in that sense. What happened at Horse Hill, they only tested two limestone layers in the Kimmeridge structure. When you look, their RNSs, well, the Horse Hill Developments Limited RNSs and ours, is that they have a net pay of 155 meters. Our fractured and net pay zone of interest is more than 200 meters. Mm. So we've actually found more. And what we've used like a novel imaging tool that can actually give you an image of the borehole in oil based mud. And we were actually, I think, the third well worldwide that was actually used in logging it. And that gave us a beautiful picture, which is, you know, on our presentation that you can find on our website. And it shows it's actually full of fractures, more than 200 meters, you know, in that layer are fractured. And it's not just Kimmeridge Shale interbedded with three thick limestone layers. Actually, at the bottom section, there's a huge amount of interbedding going on between the limestone and the shales. That has not been tested, or we don't know whether that's present at Horse Hill. We have it, and because it's fully fractured, that's a really attractive zone of interest.
Yeah, I did think that, but the accuracy of that question, and also this one here, and I'm gonna tell, is no oil play mentioned in the RNS, or what to expect from Portland. Could you explain why, please?
Well, as I alluded to in the first question, we have one borehole, and we'd like to produce from a 200 meter thick section in the Kimmeridge. That kind of fills up the hole. There's only a 6-inch hole in diameter, and that is all we can use from it, and it will hopefully produce a lot. But it kind of excludes them producing from the Portland or from the Karelian. The good thing that is to say is that the Portland gave us exactly the readings that we thought it would be giving us, and therefore we always went in there and said there's going to be a nice 100 plus barrel a day producer from the Portland, and with the information that we have right now, we're pretty certain that it will do so. However, if we can produce more from the Kimmeridge, that is obviously what we would like to proceed with.
Yeah, okay. And the last question is, would you need further funds to drill the 6 permitted wells?
Well, we are fully funded to drill, basically to execute our business plan. And our business plan for the next 3 months is to put Brockham into production from the Kimmeridge, to drill the Litsi 2 production well, and to participate in the Holmboot exploration well. That is fully funded together with OPEC, so we have no reason to go back to the market for that. As soon as we've put, you know, the Kimmeridge into production from the Brockham, who knows how fast we can accelerate it and how fast we want to do it. But basically, for the current production plan, and let's not forget, is that the Brockham well and the Litsi well, they will make the company fully cash flow positive. We actually kind of use that to accelerate, you know, future growth.
Yeah, yeah. So just a quick question from me. So, Paul, as of yet, everything you've done so far, are you happy with? Has it gone to plan? Has it exceeded expectations or what?
Well, as a management team, really, with the RNS that we released last Friday, where we gave the full, you know, log interpretation results of the BRX4SET sidetrack, we could not have asked for a better result. So as a management team, we're super excited. We are glad that we're delivering on the business plan as we promised our investors that participated in the IPO. And, well, hopefully, and there will be a lot more good news to follow because, we're going through a transformational period in the Weil Basin and also for the company. And it's really an exciting time.
Excellent. Well, one final thing, Paul. At Vox Markets, on the podcast every day, I highlight the top 5 most followed companies. So if anyone's not following you right now, could you give them 3 reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please?
Well, we will be drilling. We will be coming with more news about detailed timelines shortly, but we will be drilling the Litsi 2 well over the next few months. We will put the Brockham into production from the exciting Kimmeridge place, you know, over the spring-summer period. And we will be participating in the Holmboot exploration well, which should hopefully be drilled later this year. So those are 3 really exciting wells that are coming to the investors.
Excellent. And yes, like I said, you'll be very busy. So I hope to hear from you again. And don't leave it so long next time, Paul, okay? Come back on the podcast sooner because you've done a lot and we've only spoken twice in the last 3-4 months. But at least what you've done has been excellent. So thanks for that. But look forward to speaking to you again in the not too distant future, Paul.
Well, looking forward to talking, Justin. Thank you so much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Joe Wiley, Chief Executive Officer of Amrit Farm. That's AMYT ticker. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. It's good to be here.
You've had a good bit of news out, and we'll cover that in a bit. But for people new to Amrit Farmer or new to the podcast, can you explain what the company's all about, please, Joe?
Sure, absolutely. So we're a commercial stage pharmaceutical company focused on rare and orphan diseases. And what we do, Justin, is we acquire the rights to late stage development and commercial products rather than conduct our own research ourselves. So our strategy, therefore, is to acquire, develop, and then ultimately commercialize products in rare and orphan diseases.
Excellent stuff. So the news out you've just had is the completion of pivotal clinical trial discussions with the FDA and the EMA. Can you explain what this is all about in regards to which product you're talking about, please, Joe?
Sure. So we acquired a product called, which we call AP101. It also has a name, Episalvan. We acquired that from an acquisition of a company in Germany called Birken last year. And that product, AP101, has a thing called orphan status in a rare disease called epidermolysis bullosa, or EB. EB is a devastating condition that's genetically acquired. It affects children, and it's a defect in the protein or the gene that codes for the protein that holds the skin down. And when these proteins are defective, only minor trauma can cause ulceration and blistering of the skin. These children are called butterfly children for this reason. EB is called the worst disease you've never heard of. And the reason they're called butterfly children is because the skin is so fragile, it's akin to the wings of a butterfly. The most important thing to note is that there's no treatment options whatsoever for these poor, unfortunate children because nothing's ever been approved in this condition. And And we have got a product that has demonstrated proof of concept previously in EB. And now the news out today is that both the European Medicines Agency and the FDA in the US have agreed to allow us to move forwards into a single phase three study or pivotal study, which we'll conduct over the next 18 months. And if positive, that single study will allow us to get approval in this condition EB, for which there's, as I said, a huge unmet medical need. So we're very excited about that.
Yeah, and is that unusual to have one study for both regions or not? Obviously, it's a huge advantage cost-wise, but is it unusual or not?
That's correct. It is a huge advantage cost-wise and time-wise. Because we're focused on rare and orphan diseases, it's more common to see pivotal studies, single pivotal studies, rather than two confirmatory or even sometimes three confirmatory phase threes. So it is reflective of the area that we develop products in. But it does require a lot of work to ensure that you have a study design that is acceptable to both the European Medicines Agency and FDA, and that takes some time. So we've been working on this now for the last number of months, and we're really pleased to announce that we're now at a point where both agencies are happy for us to move forward with this single pivotal. The most important component of which is that we have dialed into the study a thing called an interim analysis. And what that means is that halfway through the study, we have a group called the Data Monitoring Board, which will look at our data and ensure that we have enough patients in the study. Why is that important? It's because a priori, or before you set up your study, you decide on a number of patients, and we've chosen 164 patients. That's what our statistics are showing us. Mm-hmm. What we don't want to do is have a scenario in which we should have added a small number more of patients in order to hit a statistical significance or get a positive outcome from that study. Having this interim analysis in our study design actually allows us to overcome that, and if we do need some more patients, we can add them to ensure our best option to get a positive result here. So again, we're really pleased about that.
Okay, and just to confirm, so when is the start in phase three, and when do you anticipate getting some data readout?
So we had previously said to the market that we anticipate the start of our phase three by the end of Q1. We are on track for that. So we're pleased to be on track for what we said before. And we believe it'll be an 18-month study.
Excellent. So you're motoring there with lots of good news, because I remember end of last year, I think it was you acquired a commercial asset as well.
Yeah, so as I said at the outset, Justin, our strategy is to acquire, develop and commercialize products in rare and orphan diseases. And as part of that strategy, post-listing on AIM, we in-licensed a commercial stage asset, as you say, late last year, called Lojuxta. And that product is a treatment for a very rare form of familial hypercholesterolemia, or high cholesterol, which affects, again, can affect children where untreated they can get heart attacks by the age of 10. We have a product now that is selling. It's approved in adults, but it's selling across Europe, Middle East, North Africa, Israel, and Turkey, which is our licensed territory. So we now are pleased to have both a commercial stage asset and a late stage phase three asset in our portfolio.
Yeah, and just to confirm, going back to EB, what is the sort of potential market size there, Joe?
Well, we think it's a very large market. The estimates from various analysts are greater than 1.3 billion market globally. But the most important thing is that we are developing a product for patients who have a terrible disease for which there's no treatment options at all. Mm-hmm. And this product improves the lives of these patients with this disease, hopefully we'll be able to prove that in our phase three.
Excellent stuff. Well, Joe, on the podcast every day, I highlight the top five most followed companies. So if someone's listening to this now and they like the sound of what you're talking about, can you give us sort of three reasons why someone should hit that follow button on your page, please?
Absolutely, Justin. So firstly, we're a commercial stage pharmaceutical company with sales, as I said, across Europe, Middle East, and North Africa, Israel, and Turkey. Secondly, we have this our pipeline product, AP101, which is just entering phase three in this devastating disease, EB, for which there's no other option, treatment options. I think most importantly, number three, it's very rare to find a company of our size with such a diversified portfolio of late-stage assets in rare and orphan diseases, which is actually a very attractive part of the pharmaceutical market.
Excellent, Joe. Good to talk to you, and look forward to chatting to you again in the not-too-distant future when you have some more news out. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin. Appreciate it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Simon Clifton, co-founder and chief technology officer of Satellite Solutions Worldwide. Ticker there is SAT. Simon, thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Justin.
You're keeping busy, and I see the last bit of news out, and we'll get to that bit of news in a bit. For people who are new to the podcast or haven't heard of your company, Simon, what are you all about there at SAT?
Satellite Solutions Worldwide is a last mile and alternative broadband provider. We deliver fast broadband to people who can't get broadband over wires using alternative technologies, mainly satellite and fixed wireless. We do that in 32 countries currently.
Wow, 32 countries, and like I said, this area of business is, we all know everyone's migrating their lifestyles online. Everyone needs, it's not now, whereas years and years ago when it first started, people thought, is this a fad? You know, the internet is here to stay, and it facilitates business, and people need it. So this is important last mile, because we always hear of these people that are left out, these economies that are, not on an equal playing field with everyone else. So you were that last mile that helped these, businesses or even residents and people catch up with the rest of the world. Is that right?
That's correct. It is actually essential to people's lives. It's like a utility in their home these days. Children can't do their homework. People can't work from home without broadband. And, as well as actually having broadband, we see demand, for data, the amount of consumed increasing all the time as people have more and more devices in their houses. They may have a PC, they may have a tablet, and maybe several mobile phones. So the market for us is increasing, and we're kind of quite unique because we appeal to everybody. We use a variety of technologies, but what's the key is we deliver really in the countries that we work, we deliver to everybody. We don't discriminate. So wherever they're located, we can deliver them a super fast connection, which is a sort of minimum of 30 meg.
Yeah, I was just going to, address that there. I was going to say, obviously, different countries differ and different locations probably differ. But are the download speeds comparable? Are the prices people pay, within the last mile comparable with normal services?
Yeah, so each country is different because obviously there's a different market there in terms of what the customer expects. But essentially, we have entry-level tariffs for low users starting at kind of £9.99. Equivalent, mm-hmm. Going right up to sort of a company size connection that may be a couple of £100 a month but would support a building with 200 or 300 people in it. So we take satellite capacity and we slice and dice that into products that customers of all different backgrounds can identify with and that basically fulfills their need. And as the product progresses, it gets faster and cheaper. Like everything else, it gets faster and cheaper. And we have a product roadmap that shows us by 2020 delivering sort of 100 megabits over satellite and wireless for comparable pricing to what you'd expect for a fixed line connection.
Yeah, wow. You mentioned there you are across 32 countries now, and I'm not going to ask you to list everyone, but which countries are at the moment, most important to you? Obviously, they're all important, but from a revenue generating perspective, which are the most dominant countries there?
So essentially, the satellite doesn't really care which country the customers are in, but obviously we have to look at the markets and look at the appetite for these kind of products and the disposable income to decide where we go. The most important markets to us at the moment are Ireland, France, Australia, Scandinavia as a whole, and Poland. And we effectively have built business bases, hubs in each of these countries sometimes by acquisition, sometimes by organic growth, and then we're building on these hubs as we see significant opportunity in these markets, either because there's a huge number of customers under 2 meg in these countries, which is our kind of benchmark for where we feel we really fit in, or because there's a government scheme that's there to try and connect people, and the government are actually funding getting people online in some countries, and they actively look for our technology to fill in these gaps.
Yeah. And what on your recent news, though, which we'll cover right now, includes some of those important countries you mentioned. So you've done 3 acquisitions across Australia and Norway. Can you talk us through the details here, please, Simon?
Yeah, of course. Norway, our company, Norway Breband, we bought last summer. And this is sort of the first sort of big step in moving that whole hub forward. They are a business that's 75% wireless and 25% satellite. And this is a great addition because it effectively benefits operational gearing. It gives us better network optimization, economies of scale, because we'll be taking these customers on without any further costs. So that's exciting. The whole Scandinavia area is very light on companies like us, and therefore we see that as a very exciting area for us to push into. So there's expect more activity in there in the coming months. Australia, absolutely huge opportunity there because the government has funded two massive satellites to fill in the infrastructure across the sort of the central part of Australia, where there's obviously not much in the way of broadband infrastructure, and it's our biggest active market in terms of new connections, Australia, because the government is funding every single customer, every single house in Australia to be connected, and we actually connect with a variety of technologies there, mainly satellite, but also using fixed wireless and also even fibre.
Yeah.
And that market and the number of connections we're doing there outstrips what we're doing in Europe because it's moving so quickly out there.
Yeah, and I suppose quite important and exciting from a shareholder point of view is that you're not funding this through equity issue, are you?
No, that's a very exciting, another exciting part of this. These companies are not huge, but it's another sort of change of direction. Another interesting part of the story is we recently negotiated facilities with HSBC, which has given us $5 million of money to be able to fund these type of acquisitions without having to go back to our shareholders. So that's great news for everybody.
Yeah, and so how will these sort of these acquisitions, how will they play out in the strategy of satellites? I mean, going forward here, what significance will they have?
Well, basically, like we have with all the others, so we've now done 14 acquisitions in 7 countries in 14 months. The majority of these businesses that we've bought are now successfully integrated. So, we're driving the economies of scale. Each time we buy more customers or we add more customers, it enables us to buy capacity at a better price. So we get great improvements in margin in that area. And so over the next 3 to 4 months, we have an acquisition team based in the head office in Bicester, and these new companies will be integrated. And as I said, we're not taking up or picking up any costs. It's just a case of bringing the customers into our world technically. We hope we offer an industry-leading customer experience in terms of customer has an online control of the product. We offer very competitive pricing, and we've been very successful in the past in bringing customers in from acquisitions without losing any of them and effectively bringing them to our world and driving margins and EBIT from there on forwards. And that's obviously the target for these customers that we're buying here.
Yeah, sorry, say those figures again. How many acquisitions have you done again?
So we've, including these three, that's 14 acquisitions in 7 countries in 14 months. So it's quite a significant number. And obviously, we've learned an enormous amount in doing that. We feel we're now very good at that, the process of identifying and qualifying the acquisitions, the process of obviously agreeing terms, funding it successfully and cost effectively, and then bringing the whole thing together and bringing the customers into our existing business and building these hubs. So these regional hubs are key for our future because we intend to build organically and acquisitionally to build in these markets. We see a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, and is there a lot of competition out there? I mean, are there some bigger players doing similar things to you, or what's the deal there?
No, I can say hand on heart that I know of no other company in the world that is doing what we're doing. We are now the fourth largest in the world, so the largest outside North America in terms of what we're doing. We realized when we started the business in 2008 there was an opportunity there with new technology coming, and also having really seen how fragmented the market was in terms of these alternative broadband providers. A lot of the companies had never really achieved scale, and we could see that there was an opportunity here to grow the businesses in exciting countries where the markets were good, but also to integrate all these acquisitions and build powerful businesses where there was lots of small ones, effectively.
Yeah, okay. Well, as you know, Simon, you've been on before, and I do say to any company that comes on, I said, if someone's not following you right now, could you give us 3 reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please?
Yes, definitely. I think the key things of this news here, which are important, are these strategic acquisitions increase our market share and our network coverage in these countries. That obviously is good for the organic business, which is very, very strong in terms of sales. And every day we have more customers. It's like every single day that goes past, we see more customers added to the customer base. We know that the internet usage is increasing by 30 to 50% per year. So also our ARPU is rising as customers continue to consume more and more data and they use more and more devices in the home. And I think the fundamental thing about these acquisitions is that our momentum is increasing.
Yeah.
This is our first serious move towards the roll-ups within roll-ups, as it were, as I said to you. The businesses in country starting to be actively seeking out acquisitions. And this means our sort of strong regional businesses are pulling in non-scale competitors to drive the numbers up and the EBITDA.
Excellent. Well, listen, the rate at which you do acquisitions, 14 months is amazing. You'll probably be on next week with another one. Who knows? Or next month.
We may well be. Look forward to it.
Yeah, well, keep busy and looks like it's going well for you there. And like I said, hopefully we'll speak again very soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. It's there again. Ascent Resources, AST. At four, it's there again, 88 Energy, 88E. At three, Thor Mining, THR is ticker. At two, newly floated yesterday, I had the guys on the podcast, and that's Anglo African Oil and Gas, AAOG. And number one, like I say, you won't get any prizes for guessing what it was after a 665% rise yesterday. It's IRG, Independent Resources. Where are they today? They dropped a little bit today, but I suppose a little drop off the back of a 22% down as I'm looking, but off the back of a 665% rise, you'd expect that. All right, top three most liked RNSs today were, at three, Amma Minerals, AMC, the 2017 Kunmani Field Program. At two, Metal Tiger, MTR, Thai JV spin out an update on Thai Minerals Act. And number one, the most liked RNS of today was Thor Mining. They announced 51 meters of mineralization intersected. That's it for the podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.